headlines, Israel's latest raid on the Al-Aqsa Mosque prompts a flurry of reactions from governments, people, and organizations around the globe. Iran says the UK government's plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda is a shirking of responsibility and violates its commitments to the UN Refugee Convention. Also, Pope Francis calls an impartial approach towards refugees irrespective of their color and says dividing refugees into Ukrainian and non-Ukrainian is racist. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Palestinians have rallied in the Gaza Strip to protest Israeli crackdown on the occupied Al-Quds. The rally comes amid a surge in Israeli violations against the holy city. The Palestinian Red Crescent says more than 340 Palestinians have been injured in Israeli attacks across the West Bank. Ashraf Shannon has more.
People in the besieged Gaza Strip held a rally following the Friday prayers to express their solidarity with Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Angry protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and vowing to sacrifice their lives for the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Earlier, the Israeli regime forces stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds, injuring more than 150 worshippers during the second Friday of the fasting holy month of Ramadan. Hamas movement has warned the Israeli regime against violations at Al-Aqsa Mosque.
We are prepared to wage wars for the sake of Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We will continue to the equation of arms for arms and blood for blood, and that Al-Quds is a red line that must not be crossed. The Israeli occupation will bear full responsibility for any repercussions as a result of its attacks against the worshippers. We are ready for all scenarios to stop this enemy and protect our people.
Protesters in the Gaza Strip vowed to increase their solidarity with Al-Quds until the removal of all Israeli violations in the holy city.
The Palestinian people are united for the sake of Al-Quds, and we will not abandon Al-Aqsa Mosque. We will fight for the sake of Al-Quds and sacrifice our lives for it.
The Israeli regime has stepped up its deadly acts of aggression in Al-Quds since the beginning of Ramadan. Palestinian resistance factions warned the Israeli regime of dire consequences if Israeli forces continue to attack Al-Quds.
The Israeli is sending a clear message to the Zionist enemy that it must understand that we will not sit idle while it attacks Al-Quds. The Zionist enemy is playing with fire, and it will only explode in its face.
The Al-Aqsa Mosque is Islam's third holiest site and has been under Israeli occupation since 1967.
Palestinians in the besieged coastal enclave say that they will use all forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iran's foreign minister has strongly condemned the desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque by the Israeli regime. He says the developments unfolding in the Muslims' third holiest site show that Palestinian resistance is alive and thriving and Israel is in a state of desperation. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comments during a phone call with Ismail Haniyeh, the head of the political bureau of the Hamas resistance movement. Amir Abdullahian said that the resistance is now at its peak, while the Israeli regime has never been weaker. He said Iran supports the establishment of an integrated Palestinian state across the historical territories, with Al-Quds as its capital. The top Iranian diplomat said the raid on Palestinian worshippers is one of the adverse consequences of a handful of Arab countries normalizing ties with the regime. For his part, Haniyeh said the Palestinians have two options before them: submission to the Judaization of the Al-Aqsa Mosque or resistance against Israel, and they have chosen the latter. International reactions keep pouring in over Israel's violations, including its deadly crackdown against Palestinians in occupied Al-Quds. The Organization of Islamic Cooperation has called on the international community to force Israel to end its aggression. Palestinians have described the aggression as equal to a declaration of war. They have called for international intervention to prevent the situation from spiraling out of control. Turkey, Iraq, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia strongly condemned Israeli raids, saying that Tel Aviv must be held to account. Yemen's Ansar Allah movement denounced the desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque too and hailed Palestinian steadfastness against Israel. Jordanians also hit the streets of their capital Amman in solidarity with the Palestinians. Protesters gathered near the Israeli embassy waving Palestinian flags. Meanwhile, the UN chief has voiced grave concern over the situation in Al-Quds and urged Israeli and Palestinian leaders to prevent further escalation. The European Union has called for an immediate end to violence in Al-Quds. Germany, France, Italy, and Spain have also issued a joint statement expressing concern, but falling short of condemning Israel's assault. Russia, however, has slammed the Israeli action and criticized the regime for turning the Gaza Strip into a, quote, open prison. Moscow has also blasted what it calls the illegal occupation and creeping annexation of the Palestinian territories. Israel's main backer, the U.S., says it is deeply concerned about the Israeli escalation, urging, that is, all sides to exercise restraint. Pro-Palestinian activist Charlotte Cates says that the Israeli attack on Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque is a horrific act against all Palestinian people as a whole.
It's absolutely a horrific attack on the Palestinian people and on Muslim worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque and on the Palestinian people as a whole. This is a site that is sacred, that is respected by all Palestinians. And so it's a very deliberate attempt by a colonial state, by a colonial power, to attack people who are engaged in worship, who are engaged in prayer, and who are saying that Al-Aqsa Mosque will not be destroyed, will not be undermined. You know, there has been an attempt by the same regime to stir up the most racist, extreme Zionist settlers to engage in, you know, the slaughtering of sacrifices at Al-Aqsa Mosque in order to essentially create a desecration, in order to create a false view of what's happening in Palestine as if this is a struggle between religions rather than what it is, a fight for people against colonialism, against a Zionist regime, a project that is supported by U.S. imperialism, by the European Union, by Canada, by the United Kingdom, in order to undermine and seize and control Palestinian land and resources. And this includes the attack on holy sites that are very sacred to Muslims, to Christians, and to the Palestinian people as a whole.
Tehran has decried Britain's announced plan to force asylum seekers residing in the country into migrating to Rwanda. The Iranian foreign ministry spokesman said the move means the UK is shirking its international responsibilities and obligations and passing the buck to a third country. Said Hatibzadeh said the move is also in violation of asylum seekers' rights stipulated in relevant conventions and human rights treaties. Britain announced its plan on Thursday to send some asylum seekers to Rwanda for processing and settlement there. The British government says it aims to tackle people smuggling and fix its broken asylum system, but opposition politicians and human rights defenders have branded it as inhumane. The UN also said that the plan raises human rights concerns. "We are racist and that is bad," that is what the leader of the Roman Catholic Church, Pope Francis, has said when commenting on different treatments of the Ukrainian refugees and those from elsewhere. The Pope was speaking with Italian television. He said that people fleeing are divided into first class and second class, and by their skin color. He added that they are also divided on whether they come from a developed or non-developed country. In recent weeks, Europe has come under the spotlight over its response to millions of refugees from Ukraine who have fled the ongoing war in their country. European governments are criticized for being more welcoming to Ukrainians than refugees from the Middle East or Africa. There's also been anger over alleged discrimination against African residents of Ukraine at the borders. And it is day 52 of the Russia-Ukraine war, and here are the latest developments there. Russia says that it has hit more than 800 military targets overnight, including some 40 command posts. It also struck an armored vehicle plant in the capital, Kiev, and a military repair facility in the southern city of Mykolaiv. Russia says its air defenses have shot down Ukrainian Su-25 jet in Kharkiv region. In the meantime, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has called on his allies to quickly supply the weapons he has requested. Zelensky said that the more and the sooner Ukraine gets the weapons it wants, the sooner there will be peace. Russia has already warned of what it called unpredictable consequences if the West sends more arms to Ukraine. CIA Director William Burns says Chinese President Xi Jinping is a silent partner in Russia's, quote, aggression in Ukraine. Burns has warned that Beijing poses the greatest challenge and most profound threat, the test, that is, that it has ever faced. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the matter in depth. Let's take a listen.
On this segment of the program, CIA Director William Burns has accused China of being a silent partner in what he called Russia's aggression in Ukraine. Burns said China poses the greatest challenge the U.S. intelligence agency has ever faced. He added Chinese President Xi Jinping is a formidable competitor lacking in neither ambition nor capability. Burns made the comments during his first public speech as CIA director. He said it's a more complicated and contested world in light of what he called an adversarial China and revisionist Russia. Ties have soured between the U.S. and China over the past several years as Beijing has stood up against what it sees as Washington's hegemony. The U.S. says China is helping Russia evade Western sanctions imposed over Ukraine. However, Beijing denies that. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Asia editor of Executive Intelligence Review, Mike Billington, joining us from Hamilton, and also author and journalist Arnold August is joining us from Montreal. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mike Billington in Hamilton. Sir, what do you make of the recent comments coming from the CIA director? It seems that the United States has its radar fixed now, a metaphoric radar fixed on Beijing at the moment.
Right. Well, you know, there were many people who thought William Burns was somewhat of a modifying force within the bunch of warmongering people in the Biden administration, but he proved otherwise yesterday. In addition to his warmongering on Russia, what he said about China was ludicrous and outrageous. He basically accused them of every lie that's been peddled by MI6 and the CIA and Mike Pompeo and others over these past years, building up this effort to demonize Russia and China. He accused them of locking up 1 million citizens because they're Muslims, and only because they're Muslims, and locking up thousands of, quote, peaceful demonstrators in Hong Kong. I think people saw the arsonists and the destruction that was waged by the CIA-trained movement a few years back. The danger here, of course, is that the U.S. and the British know that they are no longer the only superpower. They no longer are the gods of Olympus who can declare what they're going to do, that Russia and China and India now, and most of the rest of the world, in fact, all of Africa, all of South America, have refused to participate in the sanctions against Russia, and even more so, refused to break with China, who is the one nation proposing to escape from poverty through the Belt and Road Program, a program which most people know was introduced to China by Lyndon and Helga LaRouche, and which is now providing the basis on which countries kept in backwardness for centuries by colonialism and neocolonialism now have the opportunity to escape that poverty through the development of their infrastructure, actually using American system, Hamiltonian methods, which the Americans have long since deserted, to bring about a transformation of the world into a new world order. We in the LaRouche organization and our conference last Saturday, which I encourage people to watch on the SchillerInstitute.com website, pulled together leading figures from Russia, China, India, South Africa, and more, demonstrating that we can break through this British imperial division of the world into warring blocks and put together a new architecture for both security and development. But it's going to require citizens to take personal responsibility for the human race rather than closing in on their own small ideas. This is a moment of truth where we face a nuclear war and we face the disintegration of the Western financial system.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Mike Billington, Asia editor at Executive Intelligence Review, joining us from Hamilton. Author and journalist Arnold August speaking to us from Montreal. Thank you for contributing to this segment of the program. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
A quarter century after the fall of the Iron Curtain, never have there been so many politically driven walls in our world. Dividing communities, separating the rich from the poor, and marking borders, walls have become the preferred solution for resolving major conflicts. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. This week's documentary explores how the business of constructing barriers is pursued with ever greater physical, financial, and ideological vigor in the 21st century. From the Middle East to the wealthiest societies of the West, municipal, regional, and international walls have become the preferred means of resolving conflicts and addressing or avoiding civil unrest. Stay with us as we investigate the geopolitics of urban and cultural segregation as seen in Iraq, Brazil, and France.
Just imagine that tomorrow we were to live in private villages behind high security fences. The Mireille neighborhood in Toulouse. 35,000 people live here. From the outside, it's considered a volatile ghetto. The Mireille is dogged by high unemployment and boredom. At night, as a distraction, youngsters noisily rev their engines. This is a public area. Only one association is trying to maintain some sort of law and order, a local group called the Mediators.
Don't hang about here, right under the buildings. Go home. Look at the time. People are asleep now.
Okay, we'll go. Actually, until the Mediators tell us to go home, we hang around outside. Do the residents ever call the police to say they can't stand the bloody noise anymore? Yeah, it can happen. It happens often. They call the police, yeah, sure. We know that because they see that the police won't intervene, so they ask us to help. We get involved, but as you saw, they're on public property, and we can talk to them. Tell them to put their motorbikes away. If they listen, all the better. The police never come here for that sort of thing. Well, if they do, it would be a game of cat and mouse, you know what I mean? In this kind of social housing, they now take care of their own security. They've learned to live without the police. That doesn't bother you? No, it's okay. I've never been scared. She's been here since 1975. And sometimes I go out. I come back at 4 or 5 in the morning. Used to come home and I never had any problems. That means there's a... What about the police? Do they ever come here when you call them? The police? I don't know. I really don't know. But I think it would be worse if they did come. Zubir Sadi was born here, grew up here, and has witnessed the neighborhood slowly change. They've only just got their license as well. I've looked after him for a while now. All he did was stupid things. I saw the mix of people who used to live here. There were whites, Europeans, all sorts of backgrounds. I used to see my parents, they'd go and visit the neighbours. All sorts of different mixes of people. But slowly people began to leave. And we were lucky, because we experienced that kind of diversity. These youngsters don't know that. I was scared, to be honest. There was always so much noise. I saw cars set on fire. But unfortunately, the police would never come, because they'd get attacked. So you felt the estate was left to fend for itself. Yeah, that's right. We'll turn over here. Paulette is one of the middle-class residents that has fled the social housing estates. There, that's it. That last building down there. I used to live there, up on the 6th floor. Do you ever come back?
No.
No. I never wanted to come back. And I never have. Why not? I don't feel comfortable. You see, where I live now, there are just 2 floors. Here, there can be as many as 15 floors. It's like cages for hens. Paulette moved to a nearby protected estate. There are more of them in Toulouse than anywhere else in France. She now feels much better. We all know each other. We're safe. We can leave the door open. No one can come in. There are no problems. We're not scared of anything. Here we go, this way. Enclosed residences are not necessarily ghettos for the rich. Paulette is a civil servant. That's nice, isn't it? She has a modest salary and a 45-square-metre apartment like all those who live here. With her neighbours, Paulette has rediscovered some of the warmth of the poorer areas. I've got just about everybody's spare set of keys because some of my neighbours are a bit scatty, so you never know. It's very friendly here in this residence. I think it's very pleasant to be here. We're not far from town, and it's a bit like being in the countryside. It's quiet, you can walk around. And there's a pool. It's like a holiday camp. But here, the rules are strict. Even too strict, says Christine, a resident. They've been sending out non-stop things, you know, like notices telling people how to behave, not to make too much noise. I think it's... Well, yeah, the rules are a bit strict sometimes. I mean, to ask children not to shout outside when they need to shout. Kids shout. If I hear a kid laughing, I don't think it's a nuisance. That's all. You know, I'm fairly moderate. I don't know. I think it's a bit much. Well, it's not the kids for me, it's the adults. The ones who don't show respect for others, to be honest. There was one person here who wasn't very nice. He made a lot of mistakes. Well, he made noise once or twice. No, he was noisy. I mean, I couldn't sleep once. But my neighbour's camera picked him up. In this small paradise, if you make too much noise, the various security devices will hear you. We're undergoing an urban segregation in this country. Some have recently suggested using the term fragmentation to describe this new kind of town made up of separate parts that have increasingly less in common with each other. So it really marks the end of a kind of society. Yes, it could well be the end of a certain type of society, or in fact a new multi-speed society, a club society, in which the public good is considered like a club. If you can afford it, you pay for membership of the club and benefit from the goods. If you can't, you won't have them. Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, where the economy is booming. The country, though, is cut into two. The middle classes have flocked into enclosed areas, condominiums, entire sectors behind high railings and armed guards. Brazil is copying Florida with its gated communities, enclosed villages. Right next to the condominiums are the world's largest slums. Two nations, that of the rich and the poor, who live on either side of the ramparts. Thais and her mother always lived in the so-called condominios. Well, the idea for condominios came from keeping people closed off, but with hobbies and things to do on the inside. There's a bar where you can meet your friends. It's also to be close to each other without needing to go out or risk being attacked. Why? Because the streets are considered dangerous? Yes, yeah, especially at night. And you can't be at the mercy of other people in the streets. Unfortunately, that's today's reality. So they found the way to mix safety with hobbies and pastimes. It's like being outside. In fact, a whole generation is growing up inside the condominiums that will never get to know the real Brazil. It's true. I really think we've created gilded cages. We're prisoners of luxury. I really wish my children were as lucky as I was. I grew up in an apartment block, but we used to play out in the streets. I had that freedom. Today, if I go past the same area where I grew up, I see it's no longer possible. Everyone's a bit more enclosed nowadays. Right alongside the condominiums are the favelas. It's the Brazil of the workers and cleaning women, as well as armed teenagers who live off the drugs trade. They form an alternative kind of justice in these forgotten slums. Shaolin has been in charge of the Residents' Association for a long time. To him, segregation is the worst form of violence. More than the physical wall that separates us, there's the invisible social wall, which is far more hurtful. The superior classes in their buildings, and we, people of no class, in our huts. Right next to each other. The city has to integrate, otherwise there'll be chaos. Directly opposite the huge favela Rocinha on the São Conrado beach are some of the most expensive housing estates in Brazil. They're not just criminals up there. There are some better people up there than they are down here. More honest people. One day, Augusto witnessed a shootout between cocaine traffickers and military police. A scene from a war film. And there was a problem fairly recently between the guys from the Vidigal favela and those from Rocinha. They encountered the military police and there was a fight. They ran off, and in the confusion, they crossed in, went out the other side. That's it. They caused no trouble. They just crossed through. You know, this wall, it's not real security. There are 500,000, 400,000 of them, and just 10,000 of us. If they come down, nothing will stop them. On the other side of the railings, the government decided to seize control of the favelas. November 2010, the army and its armored cars are called in. 4 days of fighting in the north zone eventually forces the traffickers out. Government troops hoist the national colors, a symbol of the victory of one nation over another. Today, Captain Felipe Barreto and his men are on patrol to prevent the gangs from returning. I don't know any city like Rio, with the rich right next to the poor, literally wall to wall. The social impact is very negative. You see down there, where the car is? Before, the police wouldn't have been able to go there. 20 meters away, they'd shoot at you. Just one cop on the corner and they'd open fire. So that was the border? Yeah, that was the border. And what about the other public services? Can they come in? Firemen, postmen, doctors? Well, before, it was only with the permission of the traffickers. So it was a parallel government. Exactly, the media used to call it parallel powers. Are there less now? Oh, yeah, many were killed. And they fled as well, right? Yeah, all were arrested. Others moved to Rocinha. Rocinha is home to countless thousands of poor. Among them, some heavily armed young men. The traffickers tolerated our presence on their territory so long as we never filmed them. And we were given escorts. One longtime member of the drug world does, however, agree to be interviewed. Nowadays, Regis has stopped dealing. He's settled down, has a family and work, and tries to lead a dignified life. Like most dealers, Regis was also an addict. I took a lot of drugs for 10 years. From the ages of 15 to 26, I hit rock bottom. A lot of cocaine, alcohol. Oh, it lasted for 10 years. I lost my friends, traffickers, thieves. I used to live among all of that. They call me the last of the Mohicans. Why? Because the rest of my generation are all dead. For many of the favela's youngsters, drugs remains the easiest career move. With the intoxicating feeling the street belongs to you. They are arrogant and well-armed, but few will live to see 30. They will be killed by the police or rival gangs. People used to look at me differently. They'd look away when they saw me. My own mother didn't trust me anymore. But thanks to God, I was able to get out of it. Now I have my daughter, my wife, my house and my work. It must be a struggle. Yeah, it is a struggle. But the most important thing is to have abandoned the drug scene. The favelas issue is about successive governments having basically abandoned them. It's just government negligence. That's why we're in the state we're in today. After having assaulted the area, the police tries to do some social work. A community police unit has set up in the middle of the favela, its aim to stop the drug gangs returning. We arrive, we set up, and then we determine what the needs are, and we try and get back into the areas that have been abandoned by the state. Yeah, by the state and by society in general. Captain Barreto's men have established an advance base at the top of the favela. It's a strategic position with a bird's eye view over the condominiums. And Baghdad, the city of 1,000 walls. After 8 years of war, a fragile peace exists behind these concrete ramparts. The walls crisscross the city over hundreds of kilometers, causing never-ending detours. Abu Hazem is a taxi driver in the Daura district, which was controlled by insurgents back in 2007. I have to go around the wall, go to the end of the motorway, and come all the way back. It's like a huge prison. It's bad for morale, too. Does the wall make it safer? Does it bring work? Well, in fact, the wall has made it safer. Before, no one could pass here. It was too dangerous. Between 2003 and 2007, Iraq was ravaged by an incredibly vicious civil war. U.S. soldiers were constantly targeted. Certain areas were completely controlled by the insurgents. Then the Shiite and Sunni militias began killing each other. According to The Lancet, a respected medical journal, 600,000 civilians were killed. That's when the Americans conceived of the idea of building walls around the most violent areas. They would contain the insurrection and separate the Sunnis from the Shiites. Baghdad would resemble Berlin during the time of the wall. The US Army spokesman, however, confirms they are also building gated housing, like the retired people's homes in California.
We're building different walls all throughout the city here, different communities, and you've heard the concept of gated communities.
Mm-hmm. Funny, a gated community, to me, just connotes, you know, an exclusive sort of Coral Gables, Florida kind of setup, which is not what you mean, is it?
The gated communities are designed to protect the population in selected neighborhoods throughout Baghdad.
Many of them don't like it at all. They feel that it will further divide the city on sectarian lines.
Well, the intent is not to divide the city on sectarian lines. Once again, the intent is to provide a more secure neighborhood for the people that live in selected neighborhoods. And if we find areas that we think that the gated communities will do good and will control the population, we'll probably build more.
Each zone is surrounded by a wall. It's like living on a reserve. We're stuck inside. The wall was the Americans' idea. It was American material and vehicles that were used to build it. There never was the split between Sunnis and Shiites before the Americans arrived. Sunnis, Shiites, Christians and Jews, we were all Iraqis first. And the first thing the Americans ask you now is, are you Shiite or Sunni?
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You're welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. Well, brothers and sisters, we are talking about the benefits, the merits and virtues of fasting, the social effects and the medical effects of fasting, or the medical benefits of fasting. And we have discussed some of the benefits in the previous episodes. In this episode, we are going to discuss some of the medical effects, and it's a continuation of the previous episode. Inshallah, stay tuned. We will discuss with you some of the benefits and medical benefits, some of the effects that fasting can have on our body and our health. Brothers and sisters, fasting provides noticeable and vital respite to the digestive system. The digestive system is given a respite to relax, to recover. And fasting serves as an effective factor in turning up this process and boosting it, especially in the light of the fact that this structure is the most sensitive of all the systems of the body, I mean the digestive system. And it's a system which is in a state of continuous operation all throughout the year. So when we fast, we give the digestive system time to recover, to regain. It is a function as a system that helps the body to receive energy from the food that we eat. It is clear that, as taught by Islam, the one who fasts should not exhibit extravagance in consuming food during sahar, during, for example, iftar time. He should not eat too much fatty food. He should not eat junk food. He should not eat food, even if it's healthy. He should not go to extremes, you know, in order that he drives the maximum benefit medically, you know. He should not do any of these excessively. Of course, eating sahar is good. It is iftar is good. We should eat to the extent that our body needs. Overeating and eating food that is, you know, unhealthy, like fatty food, is not good. It's going to damage our health. And if we continue to eat too much food, we will have, for example, nightmares. And it's very much possible that the results might be obviously a negative effect. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand there crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Treatment by means of fasting is a scientific subject that has been studied by different scholars and different scientists, and many scholars over the years have conducted research. Fasting definitely has a positive effect, and this scientist in the experimental science has come to the conclusion that one can treat himself, his diseases, his illnesses by means of fasting. Because treatment by means of fasting possesses special benefits and is useful for curing the weakness of the intestine, acute and chronic inflammation, you know, internal and external, you know, diseases, tuberculosis, and of course rheumatism, peeling of the skin, and also dermatological or skin diseases and diseases of the eyes, sugar disorders and skin, you know, kidney problems and liver problems and other diseases. These are some of the diseases that can be obviously cured by fasting. And these scientists, in fact, come to the conclusion that the best way to cure your, you know, stomach problem or to cure, for example, chronic inflammation is to abstain from eating food. The diseases which I mentioned are not the only ones that can be treated or cured by means of fasting, by means of abstinence of food. Rather, there are diseases that are associated with the very foundation of the body, and they are diseases which are intertwined with its very cells, such as cancer, tuberculosis, plague, and they can also be treated by this means, by the means of fasting. The Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, has been reported to have said that he, addressing his companions, said, "Sumu tasihu." And this is a well-known tradition. The noble prophet said, "Sumu tasihu." You should fast and you will regain your health. Fasting leads to recovering, to regaining your health. Sumu tasihu. If we trust God and if we trust the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and we observe fast, there's no doubt that we will end up becoming healthier than ever before. We have to trust the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, when he says, "Sumu tasihu," regain fast and you will regain your health. There are many accounts, dear brothers and sisters, of people who have observed fast in the month of Ramadan and out of the month of Ramadan. It's not only the fasting in the month of Ramadan that has its benefits on the individual's health. It's also fasting at any time, in any season, in the winter, in the summer, and at any time that can have this impact.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Dear brothers and sisters, there's also a saying from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, who said, if we just pay attention to this saying of the Holy Prophet, we will definitely understand. And this, saying, "Al-ma'idatu baytu kullu da'in," this is also a hadith that has been narrated from Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam and from other imams, infallible imams, peace be upon them. Now, we need to understand this verse, to concentrate and to contemplate on this verse, what it actually suggests, what it implies. So, and the stomach is the house of every pain, of every illness, of every ailment. You know, it depends on what you eat, on what you consume on a daily basis. If you eat something, and if you overeat, if you continuously eat something, you are going to harm yourself. So eating must be, balanced. One should not overeat, and one should not eat everything that he comes across. We should make sure that we eat healthy food and not any kind of food. We should make sure that the food we eat is halal and that the food that we eat is healthy, not fatty, not junky. Abstinence and abstaining from eating is a means of treatment. It's a means of cure. If you want to treat your illness, you have to abstain from eating everything that you come across. You have to be careful about eating. Do not eat too much. Do not overeat. And do not eat things that are harmful to your health. That's all for this session. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share.
You heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.